Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. It's a prairie edition of Garden Talk today. And we're happy to have Neil DeBole with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. And so we're going to talk about prairies. What work are you doing in your prairie garden as winter approaches? Which plants did you put in this season? How'd they do? Are you planning a prairie garden for next year? Lots of questions here. What wildflowers and grasses do you plan to use? We'll talk about all that. And you can join in with your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Neil DeBole, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be with you. Sorry I couldn't be in the studio today, but we're out planting prairie. So here we go.
So you're a busy guy.
I guess that would be an accurate assessment. Yeah, we're kind of busy.
So what makes you busy? What's going on with folks now?
You know, it's a really good question, Larry. What has really been great is that people have come to appreciate native plants over the last 35 years that I've been in business, from being considered weeds to now being considered integral parts of their outdoor living environment. And it's gone beyond just gardening for the sake of beauty to the level of gardening for all life. And like we like to say at Prairie Nursery, bring your landscape to life with native plants, because you're going to get more than just flowers and grasses and ferns. You're going to get pollinators and birds and butterflies and all the wonderful wildlife that are associated with our native plant community.
Yeah. And this time of year, is this when we do dormant prairie seeding? Is that what you're up to right now?
Yep. We're planting 12.25 acres of dormant prairie seeding, and we're using a nurse crop, an annual rye nurse crop. You can use annual rye or oats to help hold the soil in the fall. We would have preferred to have gotten this project done a month ago, but there were a number of delays, including weather. So we're on the very cusp now of planting as far as on some slopes. We got some sloping areas, which was a little riskier. But if you have level areas, you can plant all the way into December, January, February. Some people do what is called a frost seeding, where they will scatter their seed on top of a light layer of snow in late winter and let it work its way into the ground with the frost heave in late winter and early spring. Yeah. So there are many times to seed, not just in spring or early summer. You can plant in the fall as a dormant seeding, or you can actually do a frost seeding in late winter, or if it's not too much snow, you can do it any time in the winter.
What plants lend themselves to this approach?
To the dormant seeding?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. To put it in a nutshell, most of your wildflowers will germinate at higher rates when seeded in the fall because they have built-in dormancy that need to be broken by exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil over winter. For instance, if a coneflower seed falls on the ground at the end of September and it's warm and rainy and it germinates, it's probably going to be an evolutionary dead end.
Yeah.
Because in a couple months, it's going to be cold, and at this little seedling, it's going to get killed. So the seeds have these little built-in mechanisms to say, nope, we don't germinate until we've been cold and moist for a while, and then it warms up and then we germinate. So the vast majority of your wildflower seeds will germinate at higher rates when seeded dormant in the fall, although there are many that will germinate just fine if seeded in April, May, or June without this treatment. But there are some that are obligate, what we call moist stratification, the process of being exposed to the cold, damp conditions. They're obligate. They have to have this exposure in order to germinate. Species like shooting star is a good example. Spiderworts, they generally exhibit this behavior. So there are some species that really need to be planted in the fall. The blazing stars do immensely better when seeded in the fall. So it's very advantageous if you want mostly wildflowers to seed in the fall. The downside is that most of your warm season prairie grasses, like big blue stem, little blue stem, Cytos grama, Indian grass, these typically will exhibit greatly reduced seed germination when planted dormant in the fall. Something happens to that seed in the ground over the winter. I don't know if anybody knows, whether it's predation by fungi or bacteria or critters, but your germination next spring will be significantly lower compared to seeding them from between, say, May 15th and June 30th. So you have trade-offs here. What a lot of people will do is they will just increase the seeding rate of the warm season prairie grasses when they're seeded in the fall, because those tend to be much cheaper than the flowers. The flower seed is usually many times more expensive than these grasses. So it's not that expensive to increase the rate of the warm season grasses if you want to bring them up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, to further complicate matters, there are species like prairie drop seed, which does so much better when seeded dormant in the fall, or you have to seed it very early in spring in the month of April, because usually if you seed it after May 15th, it won't germinate at all. And unlike many of your flower seeds, which if they're planted in spring and they don't come up, they will often sit in the soil over the summer and the next winter, and then come up the next spring, a year later. But prairie drop seed rarely will do that, and that seed is fairly expensive. So yeah. You really want to make sure that you time your seeding based upon the species that you're planting. So there is the very short description of dormant seeding.
I heard you mention moist conditions. What about water? Do fall seeded prairies need a lot of water?
No, because you're doing it naturally, and they will germinate on their own schedule in spring. And the only time in which a fall-seeded dormant prairie planting would need water is if you have a very dry spring. And this happened in 2012. This was the exception. When we had that terrible dry weather in 2012, this also happened back in 1988, where we had a very dry spring. So in those situations, it would have been beneficial to water your prairie. Now, we planted prairies in 88. And they didn't really come up very much, but a lot of the it was really disappointing. But a lot of the flowers came up the next year because the seeds survived that summer and over the next winter and germinated next year, and many of them came up with just fine germination. The grasses generally did not exhibit that because grass seeds typically have a much shorter lifespan in the soil. They don't have the hard seed coat in most cases that gives them longevity, as do many of the flowers.
You know what? Ben in Prairie du Chien has a question for you, so let's go there, a comment. Ben, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I talked my dad into planting a prairie last year just in the side yard, another steep slope, and he had the notion that more seeds was better than less seeds, and it looks like he overseeded a species that we're calling brown-eyed Susan. And this is the second year of the planting, and this year it just came up pretty much solid brown-eyed Susan. And yeah. I'm a little concerned about it. I'm not quite sure of the life cycle of the plants. I'm not seeing much in the understory, just wondering if you've had any experience with that.
Sure. You have a classic example of too much of a good thing being a problem. Brown-eyed Susan, like its cousin Black-eyed Susan, they're both biennials. So if you seeded this 2 years ago, they would grow their basal rosettes in the first growing season, 2016, and then they go gangbusters with blooming in 2017. And for some reason, 2017, I think it was all the rain, I have never seen brown-eyed Susans as robust and big as this. I mean, some of them are 6 feet tall this year in some people's gardens. It's insane. Normally, it's 2 to 3 feet. It went crazy this year, probably from the rain. And they cast a lot of shade, which can shade out your other young prairie seedlings, other perennials. So it can be a serious problem if it's too dense. It could actually have killed your prairie seedlings of the perennials that are slower growing in the understory simply by shading them out.
So what do you do?
You cut them down. You treat them like a weed. And ecologically, they are weeds because biennials, such as Black-eyed Susan or Brown-eyed Susan, ecologically, behaviorally, are fast-growing, early successional species that colonize open, disturbed ground. And so if they're going to be a problem and they get too big or too dense, then you have to mow them back like you would any other weed in the first couple of years. Normally, the first year is not a problem because they're just basal rosettes, but the second year, when they send up their blooms and their stalks, that's when they can become problematic, like any other biennial, quote-unquote, weed. So just whack them down to about 12 inches so there's sufficient sunlight to get down to the slower-growing perennial seedlings underneath them.
There you go.
All right. Thank you much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And you do that now?
No, you would have done it in July.
So is it next July, then, that Ben does this, or what?
Well, yeah. What they do, they will self-sow. So this whole cycle will start over. If there's open ground, they need open soil in order to germinate. Once a prairie develops, usually by the fifth or sixth year, and the perennials begin to take over, brown-eyed Susan and black-eyed Susan basically practically disappear, assuming that your perennials have taken over. So they need open soil in order to germinate. That's just their habitat. And next year, if you still have open soil because your perennials are not going well, then it will germinate again from the seeds that were produced this year. And then in 2 years, 2019, you'll have big, giant brown-eyed Susans again. So you want to be on the alert for those guys if that's what happens.
There you go. Thanks, Ben.
Yep, no worries.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way, with your questions as we talk prairies with Neil DeBoll of Prairie Nursery. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. And certainly if you have some cool prairie photos, I always love to see those on the Facebook page as well. So you can send them in too. What about transplants? Is it too late to install transplants in our prairie gardens for the season?
It depends on the method that you use, Larry. Generally, we recommend that people have the transplants in by early October. And we ship plants in spring and fall, but our fall shipping season ends usually about the second week in October, because it does get a little tricky as you get later into fall, because the plants don't have sufficient time to become well-rooted. And they can be subject to winter kill through frost heave, where the plant is actually ejected from the soil by the water freezing and thawing in the soil, or just by exposure to cold. Now, there are steps that you can take to prevent this, and that's called mulching heavily. Now, there are different types of mulches and different ways to apply mulches to protect your plants. What you want is a mulch that will provide a thermal blanket. So here is what we do. If we have a late season project, or anybody, and anybody can do this, you install your plants, and if the weather is still warm, let them grow. Let them get established, because if the sun is out, like this weather we're having now, the plants will grow, and even if they're not growing above ground, their soil may be warm enough for the roots to begin to develop some. So you want to give them a chance to develop as long as the weather is warm. But as the weather starts to turn cold and you start to get frost at night, at some point, and as the leaves go dormant, too. If the leaves are still green, generally you want to leave them in place so they can photosynthesize and become more established. But usually by about mid-November or so, when the weather starts to turn cold, assuming that it does, or whenever that occurs, the best way to protect the plants is to mark each plant with a little flag. You know those little steel wire flags?
Yeah.
That are plastic, okay? And you can color code the plants if you want, so you can have different colors for each species if you so desire. Mark each plant right at the top, right where the root is, the root crown, right where the plant will emerge in the spring. And then cover the entire planting with 6 inches of clean, weed-free winter wheat straw. So now you have a straw blanket about 6 inches thick. Just cover the whole thing. And now the flags mark the plants.
Oh.
That provides you with a blanket that will protect those plants from extreme cold and very rapid changes in temperature. That's what kills plants, is not necessarily the extremes, but the rate of change. And so that straw blanket will greatly ameliorate the rate of change and the penetration of cold into the soil. Over the winter, it will compress due to snow and just general weathering to about a 2-inch layer of straw. Well, isn't that a perfect layer of straw for your spring plants?
Yeah.
It's the exact amount of density that you want, thickness. So you go around April 1, when the plants are going to start to wake up and emerge, you go to each one of the flags, and you just pull back the mulch in about a 2-inch diameter circle where the root crown is, where the plant will emerge, leaving the mulch in place everywhere else to, number one, hold in moisture, number two, naturally prevent weeds from germinating, because they bury the weed seeds, and most weed seeds require light in order to germinate, so the straw prevents light from penetrating to the soil surface where the weed seeds are, and you have minimal germination except where you took the straw away from around the root crown. You will get weeds that come up there, but they should be easily pulled. And any weeds that do come up through the straw are usually easily pulled because they're not deeply rooted. So you have winter cold control, then you have moisture retention the next spring from the soil moisture that remains from the snow melt. So you hopefully won't have to water as the plants are coming up, and you get weed control all in one fell swoop.
Sounds like a plan to me. I like that idea.
It really works.
Neil DeBoll, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Nyesha Ellison, our on-air producer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at prairies on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. And he's a consulting ecologist as well. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening in. I think we have one open line at 800-642-1234, so you can give a call. In the meantime, let's go to Margaret in Brooklyn. Margaret, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. So about 12 years ago, I established a prairie, and I used the Prairie Nursery medium soil seed, and I established it in the spring. Every spring I burn it, and it's been doing great. Up until about 3 years ago, I had one section that got really taken over by thistles. Despite the fact that I kept cutting them, trying to dig up the root systems, whatever, I just got so frustrated, I did the big no-no and put the 2,4-D on, which was fine because then I still had my prairie grass. So now my question is, I have this bare area, and I kept hoping that the prairie will eventually fill itself back in, and I'm not sure when I can do that and how I do it. And then the second problem is, this year I noticed that now I have Chinese lantern that invaded another part of the prairie.
Hmm.
Okay, well, let me ask you a few questions. I assume you had Canada thistle, is that correct? The perennial?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real booger. Yeah, so your question is, when can you overseed with the prairie flowers in this area where you use a 2,4-D, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, when did you spray?
I sprayed, I want to say midsummer, and then, midsummer, and then again late summer, when I started noticing the thistles were just out of control.
Okay. Well, 2,4-D generally has a fairly short residence time in the soil. It breaks down quite rapidly, which is why a lot of people use it. I don't like to use that stuff myself, but it does break down rapidly. And it's interesting, it's a conundrum, because a lot of your more lower toxicity herbicides, like aminopyrrolid, milestone, and clopyrrolid, these are rated as lower risk because of innate toxicity, but they break down much more slowly in the soil, so you have a much longer time period before you can reseed. But because 2,4-D breaks down quite rapidly, you could safely go in and overseed this area with your wildflowers this fall. In fact, even if you had used milestone or turflon or any of these other broadleaf herbicides to kill things like thistle, you could still overseed this fall because the seedlings will not germinate until next spring, which will be 9 months after the application.
Okay.
The herbicide. And so you'll be safe to do that this fall. And fall is the best time to put in the flower seed that we talked about because it helps break seed dormancy.
But how do you do it through the debris that's currently on the ground?
Well, you have open soil, or is it all populated by grass?
It's all populated by grass.
So you have a dense stand of grass, correct?
Yep.
That is a bit problematic because once you have a sod that has formed, whether it's by prairie grass, weed grass, or whatever, the efficiency of adding seeds of wildflowers to the area is greatly reduced because there's no open soil for them in which to germinate.
Okay.
So the best thing you can do would be to burn it this fall and then go out and scratch that soil with like a three-prong little hair, you know, harrow on the end of a handle, and really work the ground up.
Okay.
Create open soil and work in between the clumps of the grass. You'll still be able to see the clumps of the grass after you burn. You should see that, you know, where the little black areas are where the clumps are.
Yep.
So go in and scratch between those and then scatter your seed and hope for the best. And now the seed will work its way into the soil. You can step on it after you scatter it, and then it'll work its way in the soil over the winter and hopefully you get good germination the next spring.
Okay. So what about the Chinese lantern?
Boy, that's a good question. I have never had to deal with Chinese lantern, so I really don't have any experience in this area. So I would not be able to assist you with that. Does it creep by rhizomes? I think it does, doesn't it? Have you evaluated that?
Yeah,
I really don't know.
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I think it does, but I've never really had to deal with that. So I'm sorry, I won't be able to much help on that one.
Okay.
All right. Thanks all.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Margaret. Tom, in Friendship, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me? I'm on my cell phone out in the woods.
Yep, we can.
Okay, great. I was stacking wood. I liked your show yesterday, too, Larry, by the way. Say, Neil, I got a question about establishing switchgrass in sandy soil in Adams County.
Yeah. And your question is, can you do it and how to do it?
Yeah, I tilled it up a little area, and I got some seed planted, but the quack grass seems to be overpowering, but I just did it.
So you just seeded it now?
I seeded it probably about a month ago.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, anytime you're doing a prairie restoration, you want to follow the rule of take no prisoners when it comes to weeds. Eliminate all the weeds, whether you're doing it with herbicides or organically, whether you're smothering it for 1 or 2 years with black plastic or tarps or whatever, with cardboard. Take your time, kill all the weeds. And there are some weeds that require repeated application of herbicides, like quackgrass, which usually requires at least 2, sometimes 3 applications every 2 months in order to completely kill it, because you never get all the rhizomes of quackgrass with one shot, and rarely we get all the rhizomes of things like bromegrass, reed canary grass, they require repeated applications of glyphosate. Also, you have problem weeds like Canada thistle and field bindweed and a few others that are resistant to Roundup. Crown Vex is another one. And so you have to add a broadleaf herbicide to the Roundup in order to kill that. So you have to make sure you tailor your plan ahead of time. No matter what you're doing, to make sure you have no weeds. You can use cultivation where you repeatedly harass the weeds every 3 weeks and go rip them out of the ground for a year. That will usually work with quackgrass. I've done that. But you got to get rid of the weeds. So if you got quack in there now, good luck. It's going to be a struggle.
Yeah, there's all kinds of quackgrass. It was an old field. It hasn't been tilled up in years, and I just tilled it. And I guess I was in too big of a hurry to plant the switchgrass.
You know, that's not uncommon, Tom. That happens. A lot of people do that. But the problem being in a hurry is that it runs the risk of failure. So, and I tell clients to always, I have clients to say, I want a quick prairie. I say, well, I can give you a fast failure or a slow success. And if you want a fast failure, I suggest you hire somebody else.
I'm not
putting my name on it. But anyway, to let you know, once you've got the weeds under control, switchgrass is actually best seeded at the same time as corn, which is the same with all your warm season prairie grasses, big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, side of scramble, switchgrass. And corn in Wisconsin, people usually start seeding it May 1, May 10, when the soil warms up. And you can seed switchgrass all the way in. I seeded it as late as July 15th. So you get past July 15th, it gets really risky. I like to have it in by June 30th if possible, but it's pretty tough stuff, and it will grow in dry sand. However, it does okay with fall seeding because it's a hard little seed, so it doesn't seem to deteriorate as much over the winter when you do a fall dormant seeding. But I would, in general, wait and plant it around May 15th is usually your optimal time, especially on that dry sand. You can put it on early May. But get those weeds killed first.
Get them.
Okay, I'm going to work on the weeds again. Thanks for your help, Neil.
Yeah.
You bet. Good luck, Tom.
Yeah. And here's another Tom from Mineral Point. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. We are 11 years into our project. It was previously pasture, and we're doing native habitat restoration in bits and pieces, grasses, woodland. Additionally, we've got, you know, some lawn area. But my question is this, what I'm calling poison parsnip. Let me backtrack. At one time, we had Canada thistle, and I have all but eradicated it with everything in a toolbox, from mowers to chemicals. But the last couple of years, specifically this summer, this stuff I'm calling poison parsnip invaded everything. And we also keep bees. So I'm just wondering, is this like a biannual thing? Was it a particularly strong year for that? And just your thoughts.
Okay, let's make sure we know what the species is. I think what you're talking about is usually called wild parsnip. Pastinaca sativa is the Latin name. It's about 4 to 5 feet tall, has yellow flowers in July. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and if you get the sap on your skin in the sun, you will potentially get severe burns depending on your susceptibility. Is that the same plant?
I seem to be lucky. The girl next door got real sick, so.
Yeah. Oh, it can be really devastating. A friend of mine walked through it in her shorts, and she still has scars 15 years later from that. Had no idea what it was. But it is a photoactive toxin, so if it's a cloudy day, your chances of being affected are much less. But the point is that you don't want to get exposed to that no matter what. And if you do, you want to go and wash it off with soap and water immediately. So how to handle it? It is a biennial, as you pointed out, Tom. So what I do when I see this along our roadside, I patrol our roadside so it doesn't invade the neighborhood. And I wait until the plants just finish blooming. And this is a strategy you can use on most biennial weeds, which includes sweet clover, Queen Anne's Lace is a little more difficult, but most of your biennial weeds, you can wait until they just finish blooming and start to form seeds, but before the seeds are fully formed and ripe, you just cut the seed heads off. And if they are ripening, then you have to cut them off and remove them, because they will have to ripen on the ground if you leave them there. But the trick is to wait until the plant is completely completed blooming, and then cut all the seed heads off. If you cut it while the plant is in bloom or prior to bloom, they will simply rebloom, and you will have to go back and cut it again. But you probably have seeds in the ground from previous years.
This year was particularly bad. So are you suggesting that, again, we're blessed with a lot of acres, so to do this manually, if I can back my brush hog in, fine, but
yeah,
we've got a lot going on. So are you suggesting, though, by being a biennial, that next summer might not be as bad?
It depends. If you have an established population, there are going to be seeds in the ground that will germinate every year, so it won't be an alternate cycle. It's going to be an every year thing because all the seeds in the ground will germinate as the conditions arise that are good for them. So you'll have germination every year. So you can just take your brush hog out there and mow the whole darn thing down right after it's finished blooming, if that's feasible for you.
In some spots, yes, but then, you know, where I've got my prairie grasses going, I hate to whack all that. You know, I've got machetes and weed whackers, but like I said, we've got a lot to handle. So this was the first time in 11 years it's been this bad.
Yeah, it's been getting worse. It's really been getting worse. And when you say it's in your prairie grasses, are these prairie grasses only, or do you have wildflowers mixed in with the prairie grasses?
Mostly prairie grass in the given spot that I'm speaking of.
Okay. There are broadleaf herbicides that you can use if you're okay with using herbicides. You can go in and spray the wild parsnip with the appropriate herbicide at the appropriate time, usually just before bloom or in bloom, depends on the herbicide. And that way you can go and treat large areas rapidly. The problem is that it will probably kill all your flowers.
But right. And I'm all over that. I buy the stuff by the gallon, but then I'm out there with my backpack sprayer, and I'm tickling my bees with it. So it's like, oh, man.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And you know, it's interesting because there are a few biennials that can invade an established grassland sod, and wild parsnip is one of them. Queen Anne's lace is one, as well as the yellow and white sweet clover. These are some of the worst non-native weeds that we deal with that are not perennial weeds. Most biennials will tend to fade out over time, but these are all tap-rooted biennials, and it is suspected that they use chemical warfare. At least some of them are using chemical warfare by exuding toxins into the soil, which reduce the growth of other species of plants nearby them. And sweet clovers, yellow and white sweet clovers, have an extraordinarily high rate of nitrogen fixation, which gives them a huge advantage, especially in the depauperous soils, the really bad soils that are low in nitrogen. So you got your work cut out for you, but on a large area, most people will use herbicides.
Yeah. Good luck, Tom.
Thank you. I value your expertise and your show. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling and for the comments. Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee, see what's on her mind. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Yes, I have an infestation of cup plant and sweet Indian plantain and wild garlic. I mean, it has taken over my prairie area, the backyard. It has, you know, it's probably escaping into my neighbors for all I know. But it used to be a very nice prairie garden with a nice diverse mix of flowers and grasses. And now I pretty much have those three things growing.
Mm.
So that was cup plant and Indian plantain?
It's not Indian plantain. It's the sweet Indian plantain. It's the, if I'm saying it right, it's not the pale Indian plantain. It's the sweet Indian plantain.
Okay. All righty. And then wild garlic.
Yes.
Yeah.
What a combination.
Yeah. Well, you know, cup plant, that plant has, I don't know if it's changed its behavior, but it didn't seem to be so aggressive. But it has really been a problem in a lot of people's gardens because it spreads rapidly by seeds, and it really does great on heavy clay soil. So people who are on clay soil, if they have cup plant, it will tend to spread, and it can attain a height of 12 feet, as I'm sure you've seen on your property, right, Mary?
Oh, yes. I have clay, and it gets huge.
Yeah, and it's a fabulous wildlife plant because it retains water in the plant leaves, hence the name cup plant, because it forms little cups where the leaves meet the stems. And you get a huge amount of activity by invertebrates, birds, et cetera, that will utilize that. And, of course, the seeds are highly nutritious, very similar to sunflowers, and the birds love those. And the birds love them so much they like to spread them around to your neighbors. So, yes, it can be a problem. So in small gardens, we generally recommend that people not use cup plant. We use it in very few of our mixes. We use it in our wildlife mix, which is usually planted on large acreages where the cup plant is in competition with the big, aggressive other plants like big blue stem switchgrass and other taller prairie plants, which help hold it in check. And occasionally we use it in like a wetland mix where it does really, really well, especially for stabilizing swales and detention basins. But otherwise, not recommended for the home landscape.
I know. I wish I would have known that then.
Yeah. So what to do? If you have, how much area are you working on, Mary?
Well, the whole yard's about an acre, so this is like the backyard.
So half acre?
Yeah. You know, quarter or half acre.
Okay. Well, what some people do, if they have a few cut plants, they just cut the seed heads off before they ripen and get them out of there so it doesn't spread. And that allows them to keep the cut plant for at least for its blooming period, but they get the seeds out so they don't spread. But it sounds like you have a worse problem than just a few cut plants and few Indian plantains. So, and if you ever dug a cup plant, it has huge roots. You want to work out, you can cancel your subscription to the health club and go dig a cup plant.
There's so many of them, so that's the problem.
Yes. So there's no simple solution. Some people will resort to herbicides like Roundup to kill it, but one spray won't kill a cup plant. It's got such reserves in its roots, it's going to be a long-term project. And wild garlic, that's a real tough one. Yeah, I've never used that plant. I see people put it in seed mixes and stuff. I'm like, man, why are you using it?
Yeah.
Don't put that in there. But it's a native plant, so it's got to be good, right?
I've learned that, but that's not true.
You can't go with the generalizations. And the Indian plantain, yeah, that's interesting because the Indian plantains generally are not real common plants. They don't usually occur in large densities. So, but when people put them in their garden, sometimes they have conditions that allow them to run rampant. It sounds like you have similar conditions. And that's probably getting about 6 feet tall.
Oh, yes. Yes. It's, and it's not even, you know, and the Indian plantain is at least a little bit more interesting. And, you know, I don't know, to me, that the sweet plantain doesn't really get much of a flower, but it does get leafy, bushy, and very tall.
Yeah.
And it's everywhere.
You got a jungle there, Mary.
I do. So
yeah. I would recommend the pale Indian plantain. That's a much nicer plant, and it will spread. You have to be careful with it too. It will spread, so you want to be judicious in your use. So you can get out there with the machetes, the Roundup, or the backhoe.
I think just by cutting, like it's through the spring, through the summer, just knocking it back. But that's not going to kill it. It's going to keep
probably
growing.
Not, no. No, it probably will not kill it. No.
Or you can smother it. Injecting it with Roundup at the stem.
Probably not going to be effective.
Okay.
You're going to have to do a full air application. Or you could cover it with a tarp for 2 to 3 years and just deprive the plants of light, which is going to take you 2 to 3 years probably.
Okay. So the tarp, and what was your other suggestion?
Cover it with a tarp and smother it for 2 to 3 years. But it will take.
So just the one suggestion, tarp and cover. Yep. That's not going to be pretty. Okay, but maybe that's better than what I've got now. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, good luck.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy, what a problem. Judy and Iola, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I wanted to know, I've got an area that's near my potting shed, and it's just all the stuff that keeps coming up every year, from poison ivy to half of the stuff I don't even know what it is. And we just decided that we wanted to cut it way back, pull what we could out, and we've got about 6 inches of sand, clay and sand mixture over the top. And I wanted to know, I do have a lot of plants that are for pollinators, a lot of wildflowers, and I wanted to know if I could put them in that area and if they will kind of like suppress the stuff that's coming up and maybe create something more beautiful with my prairie flowers.
Insufficient data. I need to know what the plants are that you don't know what they are in order to give you any kind of reasonable advice.
I know there's stinging nettle in there, and there's poison ivy, and then there's just part of the roots of the trees, you know, little scrappy trees that are coming up. And some of the stuff, I don't even know what it is, but we just got tired of looking at it, and I didn't know if I could put some of my prairie flowers in there and if they would survive and maybe push out some of those invasive species.
Probably not. You have a beautiful native garden from hell. It's the nettles, sticking nettles, poison ivy. Have you got some ragweed in there to add to the soil?
No, I don't. I don't have a lot of nettles because it's a very small area. It's probably only 10 by 10. I've got enough nettles to supply the whole state of Wisconsin for forever in my almost 2 acres.
Okay. So in this area, have you dug out all the roots, or did you just rip out the stems at the surface?
The stuff that was easy to pull up, my husband pulled up, but there's some things that are probably roots of the tree. I think it's a popple. And maybe some other ones that want to come up that are popples. Am I just like beating my head against the wall by trying to do this, or just...
don't go there. Do not do this. No, you have only begun the process because those roots are still in the ground. And you said you put 6 inches of sandy clay soil over the top of this after you pulled everything out. Is that correct?
Yeah, we put that over the top.
Okay, the popple will come up right through it. The poison ivy will probably come right through that. The stinging nettle may come up through that. These are rhizomatous plants. They have extremely powerful roots, and you can cover them with soil, and they'll say, okay, whatever. We just shoot right up through it. Our Canada thistle will do the same thing. Many rhizomatous weedy plants will do that. I've seen Canada thistle push up through 2 inches of fresh blacktop that was put on the shoulder of the highway, and every day I walked to school, and every day this little bulge started coming up through the fresh blacktop, and all of a sudden the Canada thistle leaf emerged from it, through 2 to 3 inches of fresh blacktop. So plants, you know, you look at you go to the Mayan ruins in Yucatan and Guatemala, and you see what plants do to buildings, stone buildings. Well, that's a real powerful force, and you're up against some real heavy hitters here. So you need to completely eliminate them, and your problem with the popple is those popple shoots are probably coming from a nearby popple tree, which will continue to send roots underground and then send up new shoots right into this area. So I would say follow the Klingon mantra of surrender, earthling.
Well, I didn't expect this from you, but thanks anyway.
I'm being realistic. I'm telling you, you got a real tough situation there, and I'm not going to say, oh, sure, plant my prairie plants. Buy some prairie plants from me and get really mad at me next year when you get completely consumed by the junk again. No, I really don't want you to have to go through that.
You could use maybe herbicides. Well, she's got it covered now. Could she tarp it for a year or two?
Well, it's going to take at least 2 years with those rhizomatous roots. And you have the popple tree that must be nearby, and it's going to just continue to invade there. So you need to really pick your battles and have a defensible perimeter where the enemies cannot enter into your garden. And if you don't have a defensible perimeter, and that includes quackgrass around the edges, if you put a prairie garden right in the middle of a quackgrass field, the quackgrass is going to crawl right in there and it'll cause you nothing but trouble. So you want to make sure you have the right situation with the right site preparation and then the right planting management program after you put your plants in, whether you're using transplants or seeds. But this sounds like a very, very difficult situation, and you will probably be very disappointed with the results if you were to proceed, and I don't want that to happen to you.
Right, unless you get rid of the popple tree.
Well, and then you got to dig out all the other roots that are still in there, because they'll likely come up to that 6 inches of sandy clay. There's no guarantee that you will smother them. They might, but there's no guarantee. So the other choice is to let them come up if they do, and then treat them with an herbicide or keep chopping them off until you completely exhaust their roots, which could take 3 to 5 years. So, you know, the organic methods sometimes are very long and tedious. But that's why people use herbicides. Not that I'm saying you should, because there are wonderful organic methods as well that you can use. But in this situation, you got some heavy hitters, and it's going to be really rough to wrest control from these guys.
Judy, thanks a lot for calling. Neil DeBoll, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery. He's also a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We are taking a look at prairie plantings today with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. One open line at 800-642-1234. Of course, you can always email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Speaking of Facebook, Wanda wonders if there is an app for phones that can help advise and or identify plants, prairie plants, for example.
Oh, boy, I am not aware of an app for a phone. There are numerous websites. A really good one is Wildflowers of Illinois. So I think it's run by the state of Illinois, and they don't just do wildflowers, they do a whole flora of Illinois, and they have some excellent photography, great descriptions, and it's pertinent to our region because many of the same plants occur in Illinois that occur in Wisconsin. So that is a real go-to site, a great site, if you want to find definitive, distinctive characteristics for identifying plants. I don't know if there is a way to access that through the phone. I just use it on my computer, but there might be something out there I'm not aware of.
And someone else wondered how your book is going.
the eternal book. Well, I'm going to be in Tucson for the first 2 weeks of December coming up here, and my co-author and I are going to knock this thing out, and we hope we get it done because it's time. So after 12 years, you know, we've just been so busy here. I haven't been able to devote the time to it, but we have made a commitment to get this thing done. So hopefully we will have it to the publisher in early 2018.
Ah, sounds wonderful. Let's go to Jan in Viroqua next. Jan, hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Neil. I have a tiny house on a double lot. So I have a big garden, most of which is planted as a cutting garden, and I grow my food. But I would love to have some patches of native prairie plants. So I'm wondering whether or not I can do that in several islands or berms. I guess the sum total would be about 200 square feet.
What do you think, Neil?
I think it'd be great, as long as you don't have any problem plants nearby, such as the person that called earlier, where they had all these invading plants that were coming from the sides. But I'm guessing that you probably have a very clean and well-controlled garden situation on your property. Is that correct?
Well, we're working on it. I've only owned the property for a year now.
Oh.
Okay.
But
you don't have any invasive plants that might be creeping into these plantings they were where you would put your
prairie flowers? Not in large quantities, and no. Yeah,
okay, good. Oh, that sounds like a perfect situation. And this actually is a beautiful way to add native flowers and grasses to your property, is to create small gardens within an existing garden or a native garden within your lawn. And it can make it look just like a regular perennial garden, only you're using all native prairie flowers and grasses. So the appearance to the average individual is like, oh, what a beautiful wildflower garden with some really nice ornamental grasses. And they wouldn't know the difference in many cases between native or non-native if they're not familiar with the plants. So it's very acceptable in a suburban situation or an urban situation. Because you don't have this big, giant prairie in your whole yard, you now have defined gardens within the turf that is more acceptable to the general public. So I think in your situation, that would be a great idea. What I like to do is to mix the flowers with lower-growing grasses. And grasses in particular, like prairie drop seed and little blue stem. These are long-lived perennial grasses, and they have wonderful fall color. The prairie drop seed is a clump-forming grass. It really should have been called emerald fountain grass, but these plants were not named by marketers, hence the name butterfly weed, joe pie weed, sneeze weed. You can tell the marketers were hard at work when they named these plants. It makes my job real easy.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, the prairie drop seed is an absolutely gorgeous grass. And it takes up, you would plant them about 2 feet on center, 18 inches to 24 inches on center, or if you want to use them as a border, they make a great border. Little blue stem is a more upright grass. It gets about 3 feet tall and has gorgeous red crimson color right now. It is a beautiful grass. And the grasses help to support the flowers, so the flowers don't grow too big and tall, and then they flop over, so they automatically help support and prevent excess nitrogen in the soil for your flowers, keeping them lower. And to give you fall color, and to give you cover for small wildlife, like small birds and stuff that like to eat the seeds off of your flowers. They'll hide out in the grass, too. So there's a lot to commend adding the grasses to your flowers, or you can just use all flowers, whichever you prefer. But if you use all flowers, you will not have the fibrous root systems of the grasses to help occupy the soil surface and reduce weed growth. So the grass is also very important logistically.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Good luck.
Good luck. Appreciate the call. Steve in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks, Neil, for being on Larry's show. I listen quite often.
Thanks, Larry.
I have property up in northern Wisconsin, and It's right off of a trout. It is on a trout stream. The property is bordered on the north by a trout stream. So the grasses all along there are sedges. And I had a forester come in and ask him if he saw any invasive plants in the area. And he said no, that there's nothing that he can see that was invasive. And I have a friend who's a landscape architect, and he verified that he sees nothing that's invasive either. But I'd like to prepare a building lot about 200 feet by 200 feet. And I'd like to, I've got all popple in there. And there are a couple of big trees, and I would keep those. But what I had in mind for a grass for that particular area was to take the existing sedges that exist right now along the trout stream and clear out a place and then prepare the soil and then put in the sedges. Will that work?
Well, let me ask you a few questions. I assume the soil along the trout stream, this is down by the stream, so the soil is damp. Is that correct?
Well, the trout stream is kind of down in, there's a berm, like a huge berm. And so these soils are up. When you go over the berm, you're looking down at the trout stream quite a ways.
So are the sedges next to the trout stream, or are they elevated where they're in well-drained soil? This is very important.
They're elevated on well-drained soil.
Okay.
Right now they are.
Nice. Okay, so the soil and the drainage would be similar where these sedges are growing as to where you would be.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I don't know if your forester identified the species for you, but most sedges tend to be fairly shallow-rooted, meaning if you get down 4 to 6 inches, you will probably capture enough of the root system that you will not harm the plant in the process of transplantation. And generally speaking, the best time to do this would be in very early spring before they initiate growth. So up north, you would usually look at probably early April.
Yeah.
Okay, and you could just take chunks, like one square foot chunks, assuming are these sedges, are they forming a mat or are they individual clumps?
They're kind of individual clumps, but when it gets real wet, they form a mat.
No.
They have a long, the grass that comes out of the sedge is kind of a, I wish I knew if it was drop seed or not.
No, it's not drop seed. No, it's a sedge. Okay, but you said when it gets wet, but you said these were well drained. But they're wet? I'm not clear on
that. Well, we've had a rainy year, so they're really thick and they're really, still individually clumped, but they're really thick grasses individually clumped.
Okay, well, I would just take the clumps out or a bunch of clumps, whatever you can handle.
Yeah.
And do it in late March, early April before they start to grow. And immediately move them and then pack them in really tightly in the ground and water them down really thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And let them rip because they're pretty tough as long as you get the root system with them. But you want to make sure that the soil type is the same as from the habitat where they're coming to the habitat where they're going, and that the sun conditions are also similar.
The rub right there. I'll be opening it up to brighter sun, you know.
Yeah, there are 118 species of sedge in Wisconsin, so you would be well served to identify what you've got and understand their habitats before embarking on this, because if you move them and they're not properly adapted to this site, there would be a lot of work for nothing, and then you'd have a big gaping hole where you took them.
I can do that. I've got the people that will tell me.
Yeah, that's
the way to go. And my landscape architect will tell me.
Perfect.
That's the way to go. Yeah, make sure you got the right match there. And then make sure that you, when you dig that hole there, don't dig too big of holes. Take your 1 square foot clumps or whatever and don't take them all in one spot. Move them around, and then the sedges will fill in the hole.
Yeah.
So you just kind of take a patch here and a patch there, and then that way you'll have much less environmental impact and less chance of other non-desirable plants invading.
Right. There's a lot of sedge there, and I can be careful and do that. I will take your advice on getting further advice from the forester and from the landscape architect. They'll know.
There you go.
All right.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Louis with an issue. Louis, hi.
Yeah. Hello. This is probably not a question about prairie, although I do have my prairie patch that I struggle with. However, but Miss Kim lilacs, and I have half a dozen in my yard. They're thriving, and they're up 6 feet, and they look healthy, but I get almost no blooms.
Do you have full sun? Is it in sun?
That could be a problem. I'm going to fix that. There's a tree growing into one part, but another part, three of them I have, I think, full sun.
Okay, and they're not blooming either?
No, I guess not. So,
because normally, you know, lilacs, you put lilacs in shade and their bloom density goes way down.
Yeah, they're definitely, if you get, I think, getting rid of this tree, as you, it sounds like you're talking about, Louie, is probably a very good idea. I guess I wouldn't do anything until I got rid of that tree and then wait to see if you get some blooms. Neil DeBoll is our guest today. Neil is the president of Prairie Nursery. He's a consulting ecologist. Always great to have him with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you with us today as we talk prairies with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery, and he's a consulting ecologist as well. Wonderful to have him along. And again, if you have a question, join in at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Neil, we had Phil send us a Facebook question. Should I mow my prairie in the fall or spring?
Well, there are many different considerations there. Generally speaking, mowing is used usually as a substitute for burning. And the prairie is a fire-adapted ecosystem that was commonly burned, mostly by native peoples, as a land management tool to keep trees out so they could optimize hunting by attracting large animals like bison, elk, et cetera, which are grass eaters. So it was really an economic decision to favor large animals. So prairies were burned, but they were usually burned in the fall. But we didn't have lots of invasive plants that we have now, like blackgrass and bromegrass and bluegrass and clovers, which can be real problems in a prairie. So what people have learned, in fact, John Curtis, who helped work with Aldo Leopold on the Arboretum in Madison in the 30s and 40s, discovered that burning in mid-spring controlled bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, which was a problem in the arboretum, in the prairie, and it also controls quackgrass and many other cool season non-native grasses and clover. So the purpose of burning in mid-spring is to favor the primarily warm season prairie flowers and grasses. Mowing can be used as a substitute by mowing everything down at the same time as you would burn as close to the ground as possible, because you want to remove all of the new plant growth of the non-desirable cool season weeds and grasses. And then, if you can, you want to remove the mowed material to expose the soil to the warming rays of the sun, which will then further favor the warm season prairie flowers and grasses against the cool season weeds, which prefer cool soil temperatures, and the prairie plants prefer warm soil temperatures. So burning helps by, number one, mowing back with fire the new growth of the undesirable plants, because you wait until they're about 4, 5, 6 inches tall before you burn. So the bad guys get burned. That now has reduced their root reserves because they had to take energy out of their roots to make the new growth, but they got very little return on investment back into the roots by photosynthesis. So they're already at a disadvantage, and now the soil becomes much warmer than they like, and the prairie plants like that warm soil. So they have the advantage, and it's miraculous. It really, really works. So you use mowing right to the ground. You want to go right down the dirt, if you can, to simulate burning, and then remove the cut material so it no longer insulates the soil to increase the soil temperature. That's the typical use of mowing. Some people, however, will just want to mow everything down in the fall just to clean it up. So it really depends on what your desired result is and whether you're using it as a management tool. So kind of hard to say exactly. So a lot of people, though, will leave their prairie stand in the fall because a lot of invertebrates and pollinators and other insects and all the invertebrates, so many invertebrates, will overwinter as eggs or pupae, even adults, on the stems, inside the stems, in various locations. And so typically, if you want to favor invertebrates, insects, et cetera, you would leave it stand over the winter before you would cut it down in the spring to allow them the opportunity to emerge in spring before you cut it down.
There we go. Randy in Hartford has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Larry and Neil. See, I put in some prairie grass, deer-resistant short prairie grass, and then woodland edge back in April, like late April. And I've got a little bit of production with what looks to be prairie drop seed, but that's pretty much all I can see. There's still a lot of bare spots. And I'm wondering, did it happened to rain pretty heavily the day that I planted, and so it's possible that some of the seeds got washed away. But so I'm wondering, is it typical that it takes this long for the grass to come up?
Well, it depends on the species. Some of the prairie grasses are faster growing than others. Prairie drop seed is actually the slowest growing of all, and what you would expect to see if this was seeded in May of this year, you would see a little wisp, maybe 2 inches tall and a very narrow little stem or a few stems coming up. So you're more likely to see Cytox gramma, which is a faster-growing short grass. Little blue stem would also be in a little bit slower-growing, but you would see clumps. And you can tell little blue stem in a first spear prairie by going out after hard frost when the plants turn red. And you'll see these little red clumps, maybe 2 or 3 inches tall, and they will usually be kind of flattened because the leaves of little blue stem are flat. And they often exhibit themselves as like a fan. I don't know how to tell you. It's not round, but it's kind of like this little flat little seedling. And they will turn kind of orangish red in the fall, right about this time of year, maybe. So that makes them easy to identify. The Cytox gramma has these kind of curly Q leaves. I know this is not really scientific, but once you get an eye for it, it's pretty easy. But these grasses, if they're there, would be expected to be anywhere between 2 and possibly 4 or 5 inches tall, depending upon your soil and your growing conditions that you had. Prairie drop seed would be extremely small, and the average individual would not be able to detect it. In fact, I crawl around on the ground looking for these things, and I have a heck of a time finding prairie drop seed until it's about 3 years old. So,
okay.
But it is certainly possible that your seed washed. What I would do is look for the little blue stem and see if you have good distribution of these little orange seedlings, so grass seedlings, in a couple of weeks. And if they're there, then that probably means the rest of your seed was still in place. Okay. Another option is one of the harbingers of a prairie. You have black-eyed Susan in that mix. Black-eyed Susan has these little green leaf rosettes that are probably 2 to 4 inches in diameter and have fuzzy little leaves that hug the ground. That'll even be easier to see possibly at this time of year than the little blue stem. So if you have a lot of those, that means that you probably have the rest of the seed intact. If they're not there, then you probably got a problem.
Okay. All right. I'll take a closer look. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can contact me at our office as well with any questions you have.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Bob in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. I have a question for Neil on preparing my field for the monarch butterfly program that I think a lot of farmers in Iowa County seem to be signed up for. Neil, are you aware of that program at all?
Yes, we work with a lot of people. We provide a lot of monarch butterfly mixes for NRCS. You're talking about the NRCS program?
Yeah.
We do a lot of that.
What would you recommend? You know, obviously my field has been pastured, basically. Well, not even pastured. It's just been part of the set aside for 30 years, and now I'm going to be putting it into this new program. And anything I should be doing this fall before I actually plant in the spring?
Well, let's look at the whole program. You say it's been in set aside. What exactly is growing there now?
Weeds.
Okay, like brome grass and...
There's some switchgrass in there because they had to put switchgrass in there 20 years ago, but mainly it's you know, a lot of mustard and a lot of different weeds in there.
Okay.
And I mowed it this year twice.
Okay.
But wondering...
Is it level or are there slopes involved?
It's on a bit of a slope.
Is it a erodible slope? Is it like a 3%?
Well, you know, originally that's why they allowed it in the CRP. It was an erodible slope, and now the first thing I have to do, as far as the program, I guess I have to till it to some sort of tilling in the spring.
Well, if you just go and till up quackgrass and brome grass and other rhizomatous weeds, they'll be right back, thank you very much, and they'll not even start this process. So here is what I would recommend, and this is the cheapest, easiest, most effective method. How much area are you looking at? Are you looking at a number of acres?
Yeah, well, 7 acres.
Okay. I would rent this field out to a farmer if you're not farming. Rent it out and have them put in Roundup Ready corn in year one, and then have them follow that with Roundup Ready beans in year two. Get that field all cleaned up. And if it's not looking good after the
farm. Oh, my whole farm is organic. I can't use any Roundup on it because the organic farm field is right next to it.
Okay, forget that idea. Okay. and now you're limited with soil tillage. I think what I would do is I would use smother crops. I would go with a buckwheat, winter wheat rotation of smother crop. This has worked very well for us. It's a 2-year process. So you would plow the field next mid-May.
Okay.
And then plant buckwheat at about 60 pounds per acre as a smother crop. And you have to make sure you plant the buckwheat after all danger of frost has passed because it's totally frost intolerant. Okay. It'll hold the soil in place. It will grow fast. It shades out most weeds. In fact, the reason there were lots of buckwheat pancakes 100 years ago is because this was a commonly used method for controlling clack grass by farmers. So there was a glut of buckwheat on the market, so everybody ate buckwheat pancakes, so it was cheap. So, and it's good for you. So you grow the buckwheat until it blooms, and then you cut it down. Do not let it make seeds. Cut down the buckwheat, plow it under, green manure it. Let it sit for a couple weeks so you avoid any damage to your new seeding, which will be winter wheat. It's probably going to be a little bit early for putting in winter wheat because you would normally put your winter wheat in probably mid-September, late September. Mm-hmm. So green manure, the buckwheat cuttings, and then plant winter wheat. Then get the field smooth again, and then plant winter wheat and run the winter wheat all winter into the spring. Let the winter wheat come up until they're about ready to head out, usually sometime in late May. Cut that down, green manure that, plow it under, and then plant another crop of buckwheat. And you have a 2-year smother rotation of 2 crops of buckwheat, 1 crop of winter wheat. And then you should be ready to plant that spring. Excuse me, that fall after the second buckwheat rotation. And that will optimize the germination of the flowers in your monarch mix with the milkweeds and various other pollen and nectar producing species. And you should have a pretty clean field by then using that method.
Yeah, very good. Good luck. Okay. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your call.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Jack and Hazel Green, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, I've got about an acre and a half up here. We built our house. We bought a lot next to us, and the farmer that lives in the neighborhood came in and planted hay all around. There probably isn't much hay left in there, but the neighbors are complaining. You know, they want me to keep this field cut down. I'm, you know, kind of at a stalemate on that right now, but I was thinking the farmer comes in every fall, cuts it and bales it. I don't know anything about farming, but I was thinking maybe there's something. Could you recommend something I could put in there, maybe to put some color in there? I mean, of course, now it's all brown and, you know, yeah. The farmer comes in to cut it. But is there something I could have him plant in there? He's a pretty cooperative guy.
Okay. You want something that's low maintenance?
Yes.
Okay. It doesn't sound like you want to spend a lot of time messing with us. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And I can't guarantee the color, but you're looking for something that might be good for bees and pollinators, et cetera?
I don't even think about that. That'd be great. I mean, I like bees, yeah.
Okay. And you're in Hazel Green, so you got pretty much like a silt loam soil. Do you know your soil type?
No, sir, I don't.
I'm going to guess it's probably silt loam or silty clay loam. Anyway, as long as it's not dry sand, and you're up on a hill, is that correct, or on an upland, not in a wet area, it's all well-drained?
It's on just a slight slope there.
Okay, got it. Well, I'm not going to recommend a native plant for you. I'm going to recommend a non-native plant that is commonly planted for bees. Now, I'm assuming you're not looking to get hay out of this, is that correct? You just want to have simple cover, right?
Yes, that's right, and I'd like it to grow, you know, until fall, and then if the farmer wants it, he can have it, or or we can just
let it go back to whatever it goes back to. And,
Probably not going to give the farmer very much forage for hay. But mm-hmm. what you can do is you can plant this area to Dutch white clover. It's cheap. It's easy to seed. It's just like seeding alfalfa, so any farmer would have the appropriate equipment with a seeder. You can see anybody, even though the seeding rate and the setting on the seeder, because it's real similar to alfalfa. And you put in Dutch white clover, and it stays low. It has white flowers. Bees love it. And it's super low maintenance. It makes its own nitrogen because it's a legume. You don't have to fertilize it. It's not going to give you a real diverse ecosystem. It's not going to give you a knockout beautiful prairie flowers. But it sounds to me like that's more than you want to put into this. So this might be your best choice. And if you want, you could add a little grass in there. And if you have, you could talk to your farmer and say, hey, would you like to hay the grass? What kind of grass do you want? And maybe he says, I'd like some timothy or I'd like some this or that. You could add that to the clover. And now you have a classic grass legume mix, which is what a lot of farmers use. The white clover will provide nitrogen for the grass, which will improve his forage production, so everybody wins. So yeah. Talk to your farmer and see if he's interested, and then put together a plan with them.
Yeah, good luck, Jack. Thank you. Ron in La Crosse, on to you now.
Good.
Hi,
questions.
Ron. Yeah.
With all the knowledge you like, are you available for hire? Could I have you come out to my place and be my groundskeeper?
Well, Ron, I got to keep the day job here, but I can stop by if necessary as your consultant.
Yeah. Well, I could take a picture and show you a shot of email of the shot of this. Looks like mustard, and it's spread all over one portion of my backyard. My question is, rather than use herbicides, which I've used and it hasn't stemmed the spread of it, what if I were to rent an aerator and really go over it, maybe not just once but two or three times over this infested what looks like to be mustard? And I just wonder if that would stem the spread of this.
Okay, that's infesting a lawn, is that correct? Or what are you proposing to aerate? Okay, so it's a bluegrass lawn?
Yes, I guess you would call it that.
Okay, and well, I really can't give you any advice until I actually see what this plant is, because you have to know your enemy in order to put together a battle plan in order to control it. So if you want, you can email that to me, and then I can take a look at it.
Yeah, and that email address?
Email address is my first name, Neil, N-E-I-L, followed by the letter D as in David, at Prairie Nursery. That's all one word, PRAIRIENursery.com. Neil D at PrairieNursery.com.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Ron. Mary in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Glad to talk with you. I live in a fairly new house in a subdivision, and it's wooded in back of the house. Not my woods, but I love them. I have planted in a very small area way too many of my favorite wildflowers. I say it's for the birds. So I'm enjoying that very much. But I have a problem. There are poplars or quaking aspen in the woods on the edge, and the underground shoots come up in my little garden.
Yes, they do, don't they? They're so convenient that way, aren't they? Yeah.
Oh.
No. So the question is what to do, right?
What to do. I did look at Elizabeth Zarapata, is that her book, and she suggested fosamine, but I believe that I can't find that.
Oh, yeah, I don't. You're talking about an herbicide.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. If you apply an herbicide to a root sprout that comes off a rhizome of a mother popple tree, and depending on your herbicide, if that translocates back underground to the main tree, it could kill it.
The tree.
Yes, those sprouts are coming from the main tree because they send out underground roots because the popple spread by rhizomes.
I see.
So, and oftentimes you'll just apply an herbicide to the cut stump of the popple, and it will only go so far back on the rhizome, and it won't make it to the tree depending how far away the tree is and what time of year you do it and many other factors, and the tree will be fine and it will kill that root back sufficiently that it will no longer be a problem in your garden. But if you get it wrong and it goes all the way back to that tree, you got trouble and you'll lose that tree. Now, if you don't care about losing that tree because it's a problem, then great. everything's wonderful, and now you have a tree for the woodpeckers if it dies.
Well,
but if you cut that tree down, it's only going to exacerbate the problem because that will stimulate further rhizome production and more invasion because it's like, oh, I lost my top. I have to send out more to create new trees in order to continue to live.
Well, there are a lot of large poplars in the wooded area, but mm-hmm. my problem is the shoots in my wildflower.
Okay. Well, you can just cut them back every year. That's one option.
Okay.
Or you can just let them grow, and the wildflowers will probably be all right. Are they shading out the wildflowers? Are they shading out the flowers?
Yeah.
Oh, they are. Okay.
It's a hostile takeover.
Oh, my God. Boy, nature is so cruel, isn't it? It just never ends. But it's not your property, so you can't kill the poplar tree.
Right, and I wouldn't really want to, but I don't want the shoots in my yard, and I also don't want them up against my house where they are also growing.
No, that is justifiable planticide. In that case, you may, is this public land or private land behind your house?
The woods are public land.
Okay, well, maybe you can talk to whoever's in charge of that, explain your issue, and maybe you can reach a solution that they're okay with them because it is impacting your property. So, but if you don't want to lose the poplar tree, see, as long as that poplar tree is there, it's going to keep sending out shoots until the day it dies, and even then, it will send out new shoots. So, that's the issue. That's life with a popple. Beautiful tree. Lots of wildlife use it, but it has a tendency to want to spread around where you might not want it.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry I can't solve your problem, but at least you know what you're up against and what your option might be.
You know, Neil, I was thinking about Chernobyl and the fact everybody had to leave that area. And then they went back, you know, and the photos of how the plants had taken over were amazing to me, and the animals.
Yeah, nature abhors a vacuum. She is going to fill it, and, you know, it's amazing, the adaptability. And even though we are in the process of bringing about the sixth extinction, as far as we know, you know, I don't worry about the planet. I worry about the people because, you know, we're just awaiting our appointment with the sediments. The Earth will go on, but we're destroying the biodiversity of the Earth, and we're going with it. So don't worry about the planet. Planet will be fine. We got 4.5 billion years of sun left. We'll be good. But it would be a real shame to keep messing this place up because it's a wonderful, beautiful place for everything.
And on that happy note, Neil, thank you so much.
Larry, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. We have a link on our Facebook page to his nursery, but just type in Prairie Nursery and it's going to pop up on your search engine for sure. Well, but Sam Shakashiri joins us on Monday to talk science and how the leaves change color, and that's coming up Monday after 11 on the Ideas Network. Always fun to have him, and I recommend you go to his website, scifund.org, for a lot of great information as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.